Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Illinois. For over 96 years, generations of farmers have turned to Farm Credit for their financial needs. Whether a young farmer or a seasoned grower, Farm Credit offers products and services geared specifically to the agricultural community.
From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is a special holiday edition of the Closing Market Report for December 30th, 2014. This is Dave Dickey. In a few moments, we'll talk with Christina Messer from NASS about a soon-to-be-underway survey of landowners and cash renters. Also this half hour, we'll take a look at what the Fed may do with interest rates in 2015 with Brian O'Keen of AgriBank in St. Paul, Minnesota. We'll also discuss farmland values for the new year with Jim Farrell of Farm National Company in Omaha, Nebraska. And Drew Lerner will have agricultural weather. It's all on this holiday edition of the Closing Market Report. USDA is in the process of a new 10-year ownership and transition of agricultural land survey, its first in more than a decade. The survey will collect information from both farmers and ranchers who rent agricultural land to other producers, as well as agricultural landlords who do not rent. The survey went out in the mail this month, and NASS will conduct follow-up phone calls in the new year. I recently spoke with Christina Messer, chief of the Census Planning Branch at NASS, about the survey.
In 1999, USDA conducted a survey because it was curious about the relationship between landowners and the people that they were renting the land to and how that relationship worked and what was the benefits derived by each party. That was a long, long time ago. So now it's time for a new one, correct?
Right, Dave. And you know, that data, even though it's dated, is still being used. And so we have heard from many users that it's time to do a new one and find out about the state of land ownership in the U.S. as it is now. So we're getting ready this year to mail out to about 83,000 owner-operators and landowners questionnaires that will help give us information about the state of that land ownership. These surveys are going to cover information on the income, the expense, debt, demographic information, landlord characteristics that will give us a better picture of what's going on, not only in the tenure and ownership, but also a little bit of information on transition of ag land as well.
What does USDA help to do with all this information?
Well, these data are very important to help lenders and institutions look at policy in terms of what's going on with our land ownership. And I think it's very related to, you know, security of farming in the United States. So I think it's very interesting that we will be going to both components of the population, not only the owner-operators of the farms, but also the landowners themselves. And I think that's going to give us a good overall picture of what's going on.
Do you think there will be surprises? I think, for example, that there are probably landowners that have cattle operations, perhaps, and the renters are using part of their operation and are deriving a value from that operation, but not necessarily paying for that.
Well, that's going to be very interesting. I think we'll definitely, all of the public will be interested to know what does come out from the results of the survey. But, you know, the other thing is to really help, I think, not only the operators but the landlords to better understand the farm rental arrangements and agreements so that they can be made and continued in an equitable fashion. And I think we're really seeing a need for this information for beginning farmers, for new farmers that are coming into and hoping to get more involved in agriculture, or maybe they're taking up as a new business. And so this will also give, I think, some very important information to that segment of our farming population.
Christina Messer, chief of the Census Planning Branch, the National Agricultural Statistics Service. Declining commodity prices have led to increasing concerns that farmland prices could decline in 2015. I recently took up the issue of farmland prices with Jim Farrell, president and CEO of Farmers National Company out of Omaha, Nebraska.
Give us the State of the Union address for farmland sales as we turn the clock from 2013 into the year of 2014 and now to the end of 2014.
Well, we started out 2014 with a pretty strong market. All last summer, that would be the summer of 2013, a lot of the ag economists were being quoted that we were going to see a soft market and land values were going to start falling, but they were a bit premature. The market held pretty steady right in through the first part of the year. We had good auction business in the first quarter of 14. We had sales that were strong for good land. The one thing that we started to notice was that any land that had a blemish on it, it could have poor soils, some non-tillable ground, perhaps it had water issues or tiling issues. Those properties didn't sell very well, but if it was top quality ground, it was selling at a strong market. We got into the July and August time frame when we started to see the fall auction markets come into play, and we started to see land values start to back off a bit. I would say in Illinois, a 5% to as much as a 10% drop in top land values has not been unheard of. Yet you can turn around in some areas and you can still sell a property for what's considered a top price. So it has turned into a very localized market at this point, driven in part by farmers buying and the amount of land that is sold in that area over the last few years. So if not much has been sold over the last few years, there's a little pent-up demand at times, and we'll see a very strong sale. If several farms had sold in that area, then the demand isn't quite as strong, and that's when we start to see a softening market. So the best way to term the market is just what I've been saying, kind of soft, but not falling, not setting new highs. We are area specific, as in our company, we sell land in over 20 states. So as you go west, the market is stronger. As you get into the western part of the what would be considered the Corn Belt and then off into the High Plains. And that's primarily due to strong livestock markets, and we're seeing some very good prices for range land and pasture lands in those areas, even setting some records. But we did have one sale in Iowa in June, which kind of goes back to my point. It's area specific. We thought this farm would sell for 16 to 16 and a half, and it sold for $20,100 an acre at auction. It was farmers buying. There were still four farmers bidding when it got to $18,000 an acre. So there's still that potential for the market to show a strong top in certain areas.
One of the things I think I'm seeing at the farmland sales that I visit, and it's anecdotal, I think there are fewer buyers there than maybe there were at the beginning of the year or late last year. Are you seeing that?
We are. Our real estate agents are reporting that maybe 2 years ago we had as many as 5 to 6 or 7 strong buyers at an auction. Today it might be 2 or 3. And the buyers are starting to recognize that the market is shifting a little. It was a seller's market for the last 5 or 6 years, and buyers had to scramble to get the piece bought. Buyers today are thinking, you know, they're realizing they can be a little slower on the draw at the auction, so that is entering into the market. There's still good demand, but it's not record demand like we saw. And I would say we have seen a little bit of tapering off of the investors in the market as well. And I don't mean to indicate there are no investors buying. There are still investors buying. But what we have going on is we have less investor interest right now because land prices have gotten to a point where they can't realize the return that they want to see quite often. So they have turned their attention to areas like Georgia, the Mid-South, Southern Michigan, the Northwest area, and there's less of that influence right now in the central Midwest. They're still there. They're just not buying as many properties.
And let's be honest, we have turned a lot of land over in the last 2 years.
We have, although I would say part of the thing that's been going on in this market that has driven it is there has been more demand than there has been land for sale. And that has been one of the drivers here. So we manage close to 5,000 farms and ranches as a company. We generally would see from 3 to 5% of our land under management would move in one way or another during an average year. Since interest rates went to zero at the Fed, we have seen that percentage drop by half. So we only have about half as many of our clients actively moving property today as we saw 5 or 6 years ago. And I think that's probably indicative of the market. Non-operating landowners, the folks that inherit land, that own it, that don't farm it themselves, or investors, they're the folks that sell. Operating farmers don't usually sell land. That non-operating landowner group has been looking at this saying, if I sell the farm, I've got a good income on it right now, and if I sell it, I don't have anywhere else to put the money. So they've been standing on the sideline watching the market appreciate and not jumping into it to sell. I think that's played into this market as well.
With the Fed then signaling that it's going to hold interest rates low into next year, well into the summer at least, what does that bode for then what we've been talking about?
That's a great question. When you look at the macro factors, macroeconomic factors that really underlie this strong market that we're in, you'd have to say one of those drivers is ethanol and ethanol production that came to its own in 2006. Another one is the increased exports to China, primarily of soybeans. That's still in play. Export production is at a record pace right now. I mean, if there's an ethanol plant out there that's not producing, it's because of a mechanical problem. And we have 0% interest at the Fed was the third piece that really drove this market. All three of those factors are still in play today. They haven't shifted. So the one that's most likely to shift is going to be interest rates. And so I think, to your question, it bodes well that we'll see a somewhat steady market, maybe a soft market, and we probably won't see new highs in many of the markets, but I don't think we're going to see a major decline until one of those macros changes. And the most likely one to change is going to be interest rates, and I think that's the one that we probably need to watch most. And you're right, at the moment, indications are it could well be 2016 before we see a change in that. To me, that's probably a good indicator.
The other thing is that I believe producers were much more eager to acquire land when corn is $7.50 a bushel. Mm-hmm. And when it's $3 a bushel, even with best practices this year, smart marketers, smart hedgers, those who are using options might have got $6 a bushel if they saw the market correctly. Good prices.
Great.
But generally speaking, there's less working capital today than there was just 2 years ago, and that has to play into this too.
I would agree with that 100%, although 2014 I think is going to be a very good year for most people. Even if they have lower prices, we've seen a nice increase in prices of late, even if they have lower prices, they have a record crop in many cases. And if they don't have a record crop, I was just looking at some yields in northwest Iowa, for instance. 190 bushel corn in northwest Iowa based against an 85% revenue assurance premium is going to throw off a payment of somewhere around $60 to $70 an acre. And then there's a potential payment in the farm program depending on where the farm program signups end up, because there is a support price built into that. And then on top of that, you've got record crop, and we've had a nice rebound. So I think 14 is going to be a pretty good year. I'd agree with you that working capital going into 15 is going to be the bellwether that's going to tell us how the year is going to go. And I am a veteran of having graduated college in 1976 and went through the farm crisis of the 70s and 80s, really of the 80s. And it was a cash flow crisis. It was an income crisis. It was cash driven. People didn't have operating capital. So that is one thing that we look at, and I know the bankers are looking at as well, is operating capital needs. And I think that's something to watch.
And how do we finish up next year? We talked about through the summer, the three factors that you looked at, how do those factors play out in the second half of the year?
Well, unless we see a significant increase in grain prices, I think that the ethanol production and profitability there should remain pretty strong. We are starting to get some competition from other countries with our exports, and the value of the dollar is starting to go up, and that is playing into the market. So we're starting to see a little bit of a softening of that piece of the three legs, if you will. Interest rates remaining at 0%, I think it's going to be positive to the market. Personally, I think we'll see a soft market all through 2015 for land values. We may see a little bit more retracement. We will see poor quality land, though, retrace quicker and harder than we'll see on the good quality. So I wouldn't look for much more of a change in good quality land than maybe another 5% down in the next 6 months.
Jim Farrell, President and CEO of Farmers National Company in Omaha, Nebraska.
Agricultural programs are made possible by Risk Management Commodities Incorporated, headquartered in Lafayette, Indiana, with branches in Chalmers, Indiana, and Hudsonville, Illinois, providing independent commodity, financial, and currency analysis to its clients and newsletter subscribers. On the web at myrmconline.com.
2014, interest rates in the U.S. remained below the Federal Reserve's 2% maximum target. This past fall, the Fed ended its two-year-old bond buying program, which helped keep interest rates low. A compelling question is, when might the Fed increase its short-term lending rate, and by how much? I took up the question recently with Brian O'Keen, Executive Vice President, Banking and Finance, and Chief Financial Officer, Agribank, out of St. Paul, Minnesota.
I want to begin with this year, 2014, because we got a new Fed chief, and so one of the things that folk do is begin to take the temperature, understand how the person thinks, and we've had a little bit of time now to begin to digest that. So what are your views on how she operates and how she thinks about the markets and how she thinks about interest?
Well, I think Janet Yellen, my observation is that she is very much a, she's a consensus builder. So she's a lot like the mold of Ben Bernanke. Obviously, you have some divergent views within the FOMC between the hawks and the doves. They tend to battle each other out for supremacy in terms of, interest rate policy and forward-looking guidance and the like. But I think Yellen is, again, very much like Bernanke in that she wants to hear all opinions and try to drive consensus. I think she is cut a lot out of the mold of Ben Bernanke. And I think if you look at, what she's done in the time that she's been on board has really been a continuation, of the policy that, Bernanke has kind of stewarded. She's continued to oversee the wind down of the quantitative easing program. And I think, what she probably has done is adjusted the Fed's outlook in terms of what are the factors that they're going to look at when deciding when to raise interest rates. I think before, right, you had some pretty explicit metrics that the Fed would use between, unemployment being less than 6.5% and inflation kind of around that 2%. Now they're taking a much, I would say, broader interpretation of a variety of factors within the data. So, for example, when setting interest rate policy. So, for example, they're not necessarily explicitly looking just at the unemployment rate, but they're looking at what's the, the U6 or the underemployment rate. So they're looking at a variety of pieces of data beyond just explicit numbers. And I think that's kind of given the market, the expectation that the Fed recognizes that they're in a position where they have to balance being vigilant and taking action proactively to ensure that you don't see, inflation kind of run up unexpectedly. But they also don't want to act too harshly or too quickly and potentially choke off the very tepid recovery that we're starting to see. So I think her temperament being more of a kind of pensive consensus builder, let's look at all the data, you know, is very similar to what we saw with Bernanke, probably a little bit more open-minded, shall we say.
Which now then takes us to 2015.
Right.
And where interest rates may go next year.
Sure.
The recent Fed meetings seem to suggest that 2% is still the target, nothing above 2. Also, there's some people on the committee who sort of feel as though that the interest rates are going to remain very low, want them to remain very low at least through the first half of 2015, with maybe some upward movement of the rates at the second half of the year. How are you reading the situation?
Sure. No, very good point, and I would agree. I think, you know, that when you look at the Fed's metrics, you know, it's, the threshold of, you know, unemployment being below 6%, it's there. But if you look at the underemployment rate, the U6 figure, it's 11. So it's come down, but it's probably not where it needs to be to take any action. On the inflation side, as you pointed out, you know, the target that the Fed has is the personal consumption expenditure index, which, not being above 2%, it's now sitting around 1.5 to 1.7. And if you look at what's happening with the general economy, you know, oil falling, the strength of the dollar is contributing to, you know, obviously is not contributing to inflation. I mean, there are some that talk about a deflationary environment. So you clearly, there isn't, I think, a concern in the market that because of those measures, anything's going to happen right now. But going forward, I think the expectation is that, you know, as the economy continues to improve, that they will be, I think, more active. We actually, to that point, as what are interest rates going to do, we actually commissioned a poll with the CFOs within our associations, within the 15-state region in the Midwest that AgriBank covers. You know, what do you individuals think is going to happen? And I think the consensus that came back from that poll is aligned with what you'd see in the market, that the Fed will start acting latter part of 15, maybe early 2016. We did ask our CFOs, you know, what is your expectation for the Fed funds rate 1 year out, 2 years out, 3 years out, as well as the 10-year Treasury? And, you know, the results of that poll were, you know, right now the Fed funds rate's around zero. Our CFOs think in a year it's probably going to be north of, you know, 0.5%, 50 basis point increase, maybe north of 100 basis points, you know, end of 2016 or 2015. And then 3 years out, we're looking at, you know, a Fed funds rate of anywhere from 2 to 2.5%. And you're also seeing a comparable increase in the 10-year U.S. Treasury. So based upon what our CFOs, you know, are saying, or what their thoughts are, you know, that's the expectation, is you may see that, what I'd call a gradual ramp up. But it's going to be a function of what's going on with the general economy.
So how should the farmer then manage that risk?
Great question. Knowing that the likelihood of rates rising more so than falling is upon us, best thing that I think, you know, farmers can do is really assess the debt on their balance sheet, and are there opportunities to potentially lock some of that interest in at a low fixed rate.
Brian O'Keen, Executive Vice President, Banking and Finance, and Chief Financial Officer, AgriBank, out of St. Paul, Minnesota.
It's National Bicarbonate of Soda Day. On this day in agricultural history in 1791, William Pollard of Philadelphia received a U.S. patent for spinning cotton by water power. In 1817, the first coffee was planted in Hawaii. In 1851, Asa Griggs Candler was born. A wholesale druggist, in 1887, he purchased the formula for Coca-Cola for $2,300. Candler devoted $50,000 a year to advertising, an unheard-of amount at the turn of the century. His goal was to make the drink a national product. He did this partially by bottling the product and not relying totally on fountain sales. Candler sold the company in 1919 for $25 million. In 1931, Sir John Hogden was born. A Welsh meteorologist, he brought attention to the buildup of carbon dioxide in the Earth's atmosphere and its result of global warming, now known as the greenhouse effect. His work led to the 1997 UN Conference on Climate Change that produced the Kyoto Protocol, a treaty among industrial nations to combat global warming. In 1982, a second full moon occurred during the month of December, what is called a blue moon. What made this one even more unusual was that it was also a total lunar eclipse in the U.S. And that's this day in agricultural history.
Support comes from AgriGold, celebrating their 12th year as a major corporate underwriter of Illinois Public Media's ag programming and e-newsletter. AgriGold's support allows their customers and growers everywhere to receive quality ag information at no charge. More information on AgriGold is at agrigold.com.
Joining us now with a look at holiday agricultural weather is World Weather Incorporated meteorologist Drew Lerner.
Weather conditions around the world continue to be mostly good, but there are some areas of concern out there, one of which was in actually the oilseed production area in Southeast Asia. Portions of Malaysia and Indonesia have been hit by some very heavy rains here in the past week to 10 days, and some of that has caused some serious flooding, especially in peninsular Malaysia, where some of the key palm oil production areas located. The rains have not necessarily hurt much of the production potential, but certainly the local conditions have been terrible for shipping as well as for just general transportation, and the infrastructure in parts of Malaysia has certainly been damaged by the adverse conditions that have occurred over the past 10 days. In the meantime, the conditions in South America continue to be quite favorable. Most of Brazil is seeing regular occurring rainfall, although this week we are in the midst of a drying trend across some of the center-south crop areas and also in northeastern parts of the country. The drier bias that's occurring in these areas is going to be translated into some very good crop conditions because recent weeks have been really very wet and rather cool at times, and the change is likely to stimulate some more aggressive crop development. At the same time, the ground is going to firm up a bit, and that has raised a few eyebrows of concern out there in the commodity marketplace, where there's a little worry now about whether or not this is the start of a long-term trend change that would bring on ongoing dryness across parts of Brazil's key crop areas. I don't believe that will be the case, but heavy rains will occur this week across portions of southern Brazil, returning late Wednesday night and continuing mostly Thursday into Saturday. During that time period, flooding will likely occur in Rio Grande do Sul and some neighboring areas of Paraguay, as well as Santa Catarina and also southern Paraná. These areas will see some damage potentially for crops in low-lying areas, but most of the crop will likely come out of it without a great deal of damage. But I certainly can't say that there won't be any damage at all. In the meantime, while it's raining so heavily in southern Brazil, it won't be raining much at all in the center-south crop areas, and that is going to allow for that firming of the soil to take place. But no crop stress is likely during this week because the ground is plenty moist. A continuation of drier bias conditions may occur in some locations next week, and we're going to be watching that rather closely. In Argentina, a drying bias is also underway, and it is a little bit more significant, but only impacting the southwestern corner of the country. That's an area where sunseed is produced quite a bit. There's also some minor corn-producing areas that are being impacted as well. These areas will continue to dry down over the coming week, and it will be quite warm at times in these areas. That's likely to increase crop stress for summer crops, but the situation will be quite favorable for winter wheat, which is still maturing and being harvested across some of this region. Aggressive field work is likely to occur as a result of the drying bias that's taking place. In the meantime, this week we've seen a lot of cold air come into the western and central parts of the United States. So far, there has not been any damage done to the winter wheat crop, at least not in a significant manner. California is going to be seeing some crop damage to its fruit and vegetable crops for the next few days. We'll be watching that very closely as well. This is meteorologist Drew Lerner.
And that is today's closing market report. Todd Gleason and I wish you all a very profitable 2015. This is Dave Dickey.